I'd like to begin the afternoon session by actually going back for a few minutes, just a few minutes, into the Session 1 handout. I mentioned this morning that Session 1 handout is like the overview for everything we're doing, and I knew that we would not get through all that material this morning, but we could come back and dip our toes into a few other places along the way. So if you could find that Session 1 handout, and about three pages in, there is a page entitled Some Additional Notes from Various Academic Conversations. And this will be the very light reference and treatment of what are actually some very heavy academic conversations. And I'd like to just reference, I think maybe we'll just do two of them briefly here. And for those of you interested in doing further reading or exploration, perhaps this will send you off in a new direction. So first, I'd love to say a very good word about my dear friend and colleague up at Calvin College, James K.A. Smith. I've heard his name mentioned a couple times here already. He's written several books, much talked about in a variety of Christian contexts, one called Desiring the Kingdom, very much about worship and formation, and then a subsequent book called Imagining the Kingdom. I believe it's Baker Academic that publishes them. And in this book, Imagining the Kingdom, Jamie really pushes hard on the critical amount that we learn and absorb that forms us, that is not only not explicitly taught, but that is fundamentally precognitive. We simply learn it by absorbing it. And this is absolutely crucial that we name this dimension as we're talking together today. Because a lot, yes, of what I'm talking about are these explicit, even if they're informal, teaching moments, and about being intentional about these. But we would miss a big part of the picture if we did not name the very big lessons about life, God, each other, the church, salvation, Jesus, that we simply absorb through doing, that often do go unarticulated. So Jamie might talk about this kind of thing. He would say, you know, if you're growing up in a medieval village, your entire life is lived within a few hundred yards, in most cases, of a very significant village church or even cathedral. And that village church or cathedral is just kind of right at the center of town. It's just there. And every day, if you're growing up in that village, the bells ring of the church. And those bells are how you tell time. You don't have a clock, you don't have a watch. Your entire life revolves around that church. And there is theological meaning that is built into the map of the town, even if you never have seen a map of your village, which would have been the case for the vast majority of medieval villagers. The idea that the church has pervasive influence over daily life was not just seen in the actions of certain priests, it was built into the very architecture of the town. Likewise, Jamie would comment about the suburb in which I live today and point out that the entire life of the suburb in which I live is built around a very large shopping mall. That the traffic of our town, in addition to the tax code of our town, right, is actually built around this significant institution. Kids grow up in a world, in our suburban context, in which materialism is not just perpetuated through television ads and peer pressure at school, but through the architecture of the town. This is a precognitive, pervasive cultural influence that is not taught. It's simply absorbed. And so a scholar like Charles Taylor can point out that up until, we can argue about the date, but certainly the vast majority of recent human history up till at some point, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, that people simply absorbed belief in God as an assumption.
Yeah.
Hardwired in a precognitive sense. And the thesis of Charles Taylor's big book, A Secular Age, is that this precognitive sensibility that people now absorb is either deism, agnosticism, or atheism. It's none of the above. God doesn't factor in it. People don't absorb it in the way they once did. So this is important to me because it reminds us, actually it's a humility lesson. We can be intentional about explicit formation and teaching that we hope to do, but it is in the context of a vast ocean of influences that are precognitive and deeply powerful. This also, however, as the last sentence into this point points out a very interesting thing, which is that as we worship and teach, as we live together in community, we send out 1,000 signals which are formative about nearly everything. And there's a whole lot more here than we can ever control. We can't even be aware of all the signals that are being sent. We send out implicit signals about how worship relates to the intellect, to the imagination, to emotion, to race, to gender, to socioeconomic class, to how we view the Bible. And I could go on with another 100 things where we send out all kinds of implicit signals about. In worship, we give a very vivid sense, let's just take the Bible one, about how important we think the Bible is. We give a very significant sense about what we think is important in the Bible by simply how we use it and how we refer to it. And that implicit curriculum, right, some educators might call it the hidden curriculum, is actually likely to be more formative or as formative as any explicit thing we say. Right? It's why there's such a troubling contradiction between churches who will say, oh, we are a strong biblical church, and on the other hand, only ever read 2 or 3 verses from the Bible in a given worship service. You can say whatever you want. Right? But so much more is caught than simply explicitly taught. And so this precognitive absorbing mode of learning is so crucial. And I encourage you to follow up, if you haven't, with Jamie's wonderful 2 books, the last of which is Imagining the Kingdom. And then a few reflections. Nicholas Cook is a musicologist from England who's actually written about music theory. He's got a book kind of rethinking music theory, another book on multimedia music. He doesn't spend his primary energy thinking about worship at all. He thinks about music and meaning. But he says something I think that's actually very relevant to what we're talking about, which is this. In many areas of life, meaning emerges when language is added to practice. There are all these people who study music who, even though they write words about music, will make the assertion that music is about an experience and you can't just translate the musical experience into words. There's something untranslatable about hearing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and you can have people write books for the next 10 years who will never be able to capture the experience of what it is like to hear that music. So Nick Cook is right against that backdrop. And of course he's saying, obviously that's the case. You can write about Rembrandt all day, but it's being confronted with that prodigal son like Henry Nouwen was that is so absorbing. Right? You could write about that beautiful Lord's Prayer that we sang in worship this morning all day long. But isn't there something about being in the room when that sung this morning in chapel and that harmony breaks out and those tenors get ready right on that little last note there? You know, you're just waiting for that moment right there. It's so rich and you can't put words on it. And Nick is saying, yeah, that's right. But that's too low a view of the language that surrounds our practices. And what he goes on to describe is this beautifully, if I had to give it a word, it would be an interactionist theory about the relationship of practice and language, where he says, you know what, that Lord's Prayer, that is irreducible, untranslatable. And yet, when we pause later in the day to testify about it, that language interacts with our experience of it. And just the fact that I said that this afternoon, tomorrow morning, are we saying the Lord's, is that every day here? Yeah. Every day you get to do that Lord's Prayer? Oh, don't miss chapel tomorrow morning. See, and now I know everybody here is going to be in chapel listening for the tenors on that last night. Because this little language act intersects with that practice. Here is the, there are many examples of this from just everyday life, but one of them is, have you ever really fallen in love? Now, for some of you, you're going to love this, and some of you aren't going to get this at all, right? But have you ever grown attached to a really good baseball announcer who announces the baseball game? You know, like Vin Scully for the Dodgers, right? Or up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, when I was growing up, Ernie Harwell, Georgia boy, came up, called baseball games. You don't even have to like baseball. You just like Ernie Harwell. But there was something about the language about the game. The game was great to experience in and of itself. But when you had Ernie's language intersect with the game, the meaning was about triple the value. Ernie Harwell always loved it. Whenever there was a ground ball to the shortstop, Ernie always called it a bounding ball. Isn't that a great phrase? The bounding ball. This ball had internal energy all in and of itself. No one hit the ball. It was a bounding ball. It was great. He just vividly brought that to light. Right. It was the language about it. And I think this is a crucial lesson for us. It's nothing I hope I'm saying will detract from the irreducibility, the untranslatability of the powerful experience of worship. The goal is not just the learning about worship, it's that deep and profound, irreducible, unexplainable experience. But wow, the language that comes around it is so powerful. And a little preview of where we'll end tomorrow, but you know where you can see this so powerfully at work, right in the Christian experience, is what happens at baptism and the Lord's table. Baptism and the Lord's table are actions. They are embodied actions. And the biblical command, do this in remembrance of me, is about an embodied action. It does not say, think about me in this way as you do this action. It says, do this action. But no one ever gathers in public worship, comes, takes bread, takes cup, eats, drinks, without words. It's always the action plus the words that are spoken, plus a few words that explain the words that are spoken during the action, plus the visual commentary or the visual art that might accompany it. It's all of these things in an interactionist way. And anyway, Nick Cook is just fabulous on the interactionist dynamic of experience and language and the way this all works together.
And also have a negative impact to it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
The wrong words are said, but the actions or the meaning is
huge.
Mess.
You can ruin someone's experience of Rembrandt if you've got a bad art docent. Right? Someone's experience, I mean, I'm using, you know, other examples here, right? Commentary on other key events? Absolutely. There is power in those words to disclose and evoke that is just immense. But there's also great potential to deform, to misguide, to...
Bad baseball announcers can ruin the game as well.
Absolutely. I can think of a few that have, actually. Absolutely. That's right. Yeah.
Are you talking about commentary on liturgy, about making commentary on liturgical actions, or...
So I'm saying that this, okay, here's where it's very hard when it's an ecumenical group, right? Because, and actually, maybe one of my examples in just a minute will help with that. I'm talking about the fact that sometimes our actions, the liturgical actions in themselves, provide a frame for understanding that action. Okay? So I'm not necessarily talking about adding little teaching moments in. Actually, let me switch gears. Let me go in a little different direction. I had it right here. Is there a red? You know, what I think is a good example of part of what I'm talking about is a category of song, and we'll talk a little bit more about this tomorrow, that I think is worth our paying attention to more than we have. There is this, you know, in most hymnals, right? So this is a recently published hymn, Lift Up Your Hearts, that I had a chance to work on with a group of other people. And this hymn has a very long section of hymns of praise and adoration, kind of opening of worship songs. But as we were working on this, we came to the conclusion that the 75 or 80 of these gathering songs broke down into two quite different categories. Category number one were songs of worship. They were songs that expressed worship to God. Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty. The second category were songs about the worship service. And so an example of this might be a song like Gather Us In. Gather us in, the rich and the haughty. Gather us in, right? Some of you know that text by Marty Howden, where you're actually singing about the nature of the gathering. Now, in some ways, right, that is a very powerful framing song. Just real quick on the fly here. Marva Dunn has not written a ton of hymns, but she has a very interesting hymn about worship that I'd like to read for you. It's called Come Away From Rush and Hurry. Sounds like Marva. Come away from rush and hurry to the stillness of God's peace. From our vain ambitions worry, come to Christ to find release. Come away from noise and clamor, life's demands and frenzied pace. Come to join the people gathered here to seek and find God's grace. In the pastures of God's goodness, we lie down to rest our soul. From the waters of God's mercy, we drink deeply, are made whole. The table of God's presence, all the saints are richly fed. With the oil of God's anointing, into service we are led. It's a very poignant. But you see what it's doing is it's actually naming. This actually introduces this afternoon's topic, which is kind of worship theology 101. If we had a very limited amount of time, what would we name as the central purposes or actions of this gathering? Well, this is a very powerful frame, isn't it? Come away from rush and hurry. Now, Chris Tomlin, you maybe heard of Chris Tomlin? Written a few songs that people like to sing. Chris Tomlin has just finished a large worship concert tour, right, that thousands of people have gone to. And he turns out, in his concert tour, has another framing song that is almost perfectly exactly opposite of Marva Dunn's. And I'm not going to get the title right quite exactly, the phrasing right, but it's basically come, join, enter God's great dance floor. You know what I'm talking about? You have the exact, what's the exact title? I come alive on God's great dance floor. I was up in the arena in Grand Rapids when he came to town, right? And everyone goes on the dance floor. And what he was saying is this worship gathering is about God's great dance floor. This is about loud, exuberant, joyous celebration. We actually try to be loud and frenzied in this place. Marva is phrasing the exact opposite, right? Come away from noise and frenzy. Now, of course, it's not an either-or choice. There ought to be space in the church for both. But what I'm saying is that you don't have to actually say a word about this text to have the singing of this text be framing what you are doing in worship. What I do think is really interesting for almost any church would be if your church had to pick three or so theme songs from the category of songs about worship, which ones would your church pick? Any come to mind? I know some churches that I'm positive would pick "When in Our Music God is Glorified" and "Adoration Leaves No Room for Pride." Is this the whole creation cried, "Hallelujah"? Adoration leaves no room for pride, right? That is a song. Of course, it's an expression of praise. But really, the text of the poetry is describing the nature of the worship event. Right? Any other songs like that? There is one more that I absolutely want to read while we're on this spot. I'll find it real quickly here, just a minute.
"Brethren, we have met to worship you."
Bingo, yes. "We have met to worship," to the tune "Holy Manna," which has all this kind of feeding imagery, right? That's a huge framing song about the meaning of worship. Yeah, David?
A few years ago, First Baptist Church in Daytona Beach operated under the idea of the family of God that hasn't had a chance to meet each other all week, and so we are. And so prior to the service, there was not that quietness.
Yep.
There was the hubbub. And the pastor and all the staff would come up and down the aisles and greet people prior to the service.
Yep. Yep.
Only one was exempted from that was minister of music because he was back with the choir. Everybody else was out there doing that. But that was built around that concept that we're a family that hasn't seen each other all week long, and we're just glad to do it. Here's a great big family together.
So I'm so glad I'm a part of the family of God. I can hear it. Excellent. Right? "And out of the clamor, that song arises and things begin." This is a very powerful statement, a theological statement about the core understanding of what the worship gathering is about. Yep, great.
For our Advent and Lenten evening services, we've used Marty Howden's Psalm 141, which frames our worship for the evening. Our excellent worship director taught the congregation to sing a part of it.
Great. That's about the incense rising, the imagery from Psalm 141. Right. The church's historic sound for evening prayer that frames that kind of vesper prayer quality. I think actually in a worship ministry, choosing these kind of theme songs for framing can be one of the actually most important central things you do.
"Gather Your People" by Bob Kerr.
"Gather Your People" by Bob Kerr. Yep. Right. Is that Oregon Catholic Press, I'm guessing, right? Have any of you heard Ken Miedema's text, "Out of Need and Out of Custom"? "Out of need and out of custom we have gathered here again. To the gathering we are bringing love and laughter, grief and pain. Some believing, some rejoicing, some afraid, and some in doubt. Now we come, our questions voicing, we would search these matters out. We now come, our masks displayed, fearing that we shall be known. Foolish games forever playing, feeling meanwhile so alone. Let pretension's power be broken, to be open let us dare. Let the truth and love be spoken, let us now the searching share. We have heard the glowing stories of the things that God has done, of his power and glory, of his life in Christ the Son. God of human transformation, for your presence now we pray, lead us ever on the journey as we gather here today." All right? That's a pretty poignant, countercultural kind of framing text. Right? "Out of need and out of custom," Ken Miedema. And of course, now, for that to be authentic, I mean, you can't just paste that song in front of an utterly sentimental worship service in which everyone perpetually lives with the mask that they have, right? You've got to, there has to be an integrity between this and what actually happens. But what a fabulous aspirational goal. So is the kind of distinction clear that even the choice of song text can frame how people understand the event they're going to? Now, in response, actually, I would want to go one step further. I think just singing the text can make an enormous difference. But I actually think the text really becomes powerful when you add just a little comment to it. It might be the comment in a printed worship bulletin, opening song, "Out of Need and Out of Custom, - Do not sing this on automatic pilot. That's a little gutsy, right? A little cheeky for some kind of... Right? It's the comment in choir rehearsal before this song is sung in worship, which says, we're going to sing a text, but then we need to talk together about whether our community can honestly sing this text. People will not sing it the same way if you ask the question, right? What would be a little more pastoral, warm, and not quite so cheeky? It might be actually to say out loud or to print if you don't like making spoken, or it could be printed on a screen, some note about one of the greatest experiences of unnamed pain in church is feeling like you're alone in the middle of a group of people. Here is a song that expresses just that. Now, there's something a little more elegant about that than don't sing the song back. But boy, if you've got some, I think, in other words, a text like this is so poignant and so powerful that if you kind of just hit go, right, people might not have the sort of capacity to imagine it. It's a little bit like the docent at the museum who says, we're not quite ready to see Rembrandt's Prodigal Son yet. That one's in the next room. We're going to do a couple of warm-up paintings before we get there. And then you do that, and of course what's happening is everybody's getting ready for that sort of moment, right? That's just a little framing device, a little pedagogical device, right? Yeah. Okay. All right. Now, let's go to the handout for this session 4. Happily, we've already started to talk about the concept. The question this afternoon for the last session is, what are the central things, the absolute fundamental, basic things that need to be said about worship for it to really come into its own? Now this, it turns out, is a lot harder question to answer, I think, than we might think. Suppose you had no more than 60 minutes to teach a brand new Christian about what was going on in the worship service. What would you say? Actually, let me just pause right there. If you had 60 minutes, this is it. It's the new members class at your church. And you got all these well-meaning people. They've agreed to come for 60 minutes. They know it's about 60 minutes. And the question of the day is the worship life of our congregation. What are the most important things that you want to communicate? Here we go.
You are talking to Bob Weber students. We would all say we are rehearsing God's story.
All right, there you go. That's it. Let's see if we can, how many answers we can come up with. Direct quote from Bob Weber. Right. Actually, this was Bob's teaching genius, right? Because he was so good at those sticky, memorable lines. Right. Great answer. Anyone else? Doesn't have to be a Bob Weber quote. But it's got to be something you put in your 1 hour. Like, you got to get through it. It's so crucial. Without this, you're likely to miss something of central importance. Okay, worship is dialogue with God. Right? You come, and we both speak and listen. Never one without the other. Other things.
Well, it's more based on Robert Schaefer's definition of it's a time when we express our relationship with God, in which He has first spoken to us and shown us His love through Jesus Christ by the power of His Holy Spirit within His Father.
So God always has the first word in what we do, and we always respond. Dash. And that's a pattern for how we live our whole lives before God's face. Great. Excellent. How many more sticky lines can we come up with?
Well, Bear Harris has a line about we look at God and God looks at us.
Okay. We look at God and God looks at us. That's kind of interesting visual language, right? This idea of face-to-face is the implicit metaphor behind that. What's interesting about that is it's visual and not just speech. It's interesting. Go ahead.
In a sacramental setting, you might even say that we're gathered to receive God's gifts.
gathering to receive God's gifts. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Anyone else? What would you put in the worship point?
Try to, Bob Weber, and have us put the fourfold worship in there. We gather to hear God's word, respond, and are sent out for that message to the world.
Excellent.
I do talk to my people about that we are here to proclaim the kingdom that is to come. I talk to my people regularly.
Proclaim the kingdom that is to come. That's great. So then you get the sense of the timeline, right? Actually telling God's story and looking forward. That's pretty interesting. It's interesting. A lot of Worship 101 content is all present tense, right? As opposed to we look back and look forward. That's an interesting kind of axis to try to get in right away. A couple more hands. Yep, go ahead.
I like to think of it as a time when we're changed or transformed, but I don't know if that would get across.
Well, look, we want people to come to this church expecting that God's Spirit is at work in transformation. That's great. That's great.
I feel so strongly about the worship service. You know, we're not serving God with our praise or anything else. Like, he's not going to have a good day unless we praise him. But he's serving us so that we can be transformed and go out. That's the grace, I think, theology.
Great.
In worship.
Go ahead.
I always tell them it's a spiritual experience before it's a musical experience.
Right. So that's something that kind of decenters the music, right? And you're a music director?
Yes.
Yeah, so you and Matt Redman are both working on, like, Heart of Worship, like, you know, making sure that the music's not, it's secondary to a larger purpose.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's a beautiful thing.
I look at the music as augmenting what the message is.
Okay.
It dresses it up, right? It does not overtake the situation.
I think that's a good point. We're going to come talk about music and the arts tomorrow a little bit more, too. You know what? I think just right in the moment what occurs to me is what a gift that can be to people, and I don't quite know how to say this, but people who actually are not sort of hardwired into music. I'm kind of hardwired into music. And what I've discovered is that a lot of people at IWS kind of places are often hardwired into music. We kind of love to sing. That's why the Lord's Prayer sounded so good, right? But there is a great pastoral danger in North America in all the churches that equate music and worship. Because is it implicitly saying to people who can't sing, maybe because they had a really unfortunate experience with a music teacher when they were growing up who told them they can't sing? Oh, yeah, that's great. The exercise that I've just led us in, this little question, I hope actually that this is a direct take home, that you will be open to convening some conversation with people in your context around, if we had only 1 hour to try to give an account for what we do in worship, what would we say? It's a very realistic exercise. But wow, it can focus on first things. And there are some common themes. Everything that's been said is a good candidate to make it into that hour. Hopefully, all of it. But context will matter too, right? Background, mission, unique context of the congregation will matter in how that's formulated.
Another angle on that, John, is what needs to be said in worship every Sunday.
Great. Thank you. And here's an interesting thing, right? Right. What you would choose to teach in that 1 hour, right, also then affects what should be in every worship service. Related to this, I think one of the most clarifying exercises that a worship staff can do might be the 1 hour session. But I know in the back of my church, there's a little brochure called When You Worship With Us. And it's just a brochure, a little trifold brochure. And I think there's it's only about 911 words, something like that. Not much longer. But what a great exercise to try to figure out how to formulate what you put in those 900 words. And then, does that 900 words deliver? Because in a sense, that's a promissory contract, right? I would hope it would be on the website, right? Someone thinking about coming to your church would find those 900 words, potentially. Well, then, what they find there, better manage.
Right.
Better manage. Right. All right. Look at, okay, now the handout for session four.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell us the answers.
Oh, no, well, no, I'm going to tell you actually some answers, okay? I'm going to augment a few things that have been said here, and I'll tell you that actually this handout actually got put together on Saturday morning as I was getting ready to come here. So there's a little bit of cut and paste work going on. But I'm going to briefly summarize what in, I think it's now, 17 years work at the Calvin Institute of Christian Worship. And boy, there's always this matter of determining, you know, what are the big non-negotiables and then what are secondary, very important things, but maybe not quite as important as the big things. And when it comes to just core teaching about worship, these are some of the things we continue to discover to be indispensable. The first two, you can footnote by one. And they're right beginning this handout. You see the introductory definitions? You'd never say it this way in a new member class or brochure, but it's so important in English to distinguish and relate the different meanings of the term worship. Without this, you can so easily have people talking right past each other. In English, we have one word that means three distinct but related things. It's a way of life that adores and extends and extols God's worth. It's a public event, which is like a condensed, super concentrated form of that way of life. And within that service, it's a particular expression of abandon and adoration for God's holiness. One worship, one word is all three. And the joy of the Christian life is seeing the connections between our luminous act of praise, holy, holy of holy, the larger worship service in which that's set, and the way that that ripples out in daily life. That little three-sentence move, I'm not going to hold them up right now because I don't want to publicly, and especially with the recorder, go online and be too critical of some materials that I did find online in preparation for today. If you type in teaching worship to kids, teaching worship in your congregation, you'll actually call up all kinds of materials. The first five I found from congregations all started with the definition of worship. And the definition of worship was kind of taken straight from the dictionary. So what is to worship? To ascribe worth to God. Great. Right? I don't disagree with that at all. But that definition is not sufficiently granular, sufficiently nuanced to actually serve discussions well. Because what happens when you get to confession and lament? Well, that definition of worship doesn't have built into it even the rationale by which you tell the story of God's actions. You could ascribe worth to God without telling the story. I mean, I think it's a bad idea, but you could, right? So it's actually not quite the right foundation. And so with trial and error, and I'm just thinking about now, I think we've done about 600 grants to various congregations around the country. And if I think about conversations where people end up talking past each other, it's because the work of distinguishing and relating those definitions is not done. And by the way, that's a unique problem in English, because we have one word to do all three things. But it's not necessarily a problem in some other languages. So, yeah. And then here, does this look like Bob Weber? Right. The move of distinguishing different levels for talking about worship. So you're in the new members class, and you give this beautiful, luminous, tell the story of God's actions or recount the history, or it's beautiful theological discussion, and someone wants to go to a topic that has to do with the mechanics of a worship service, or I love the band, that's why I want to go to this church, right? Or I love the organist, right? Their comment right away goes to a stylistically driven concern. And so we have found time and time again, and this is straight from Bob, bless him, how important it is to distinguish. They're never completely unrelated, of course. But discussions about the mechanics of a worship service, you know, like where people stand and who turns on the mics and all that kind of stuff. The style of a worship, the pattern of worship, and worship's deep meaning and purpose. And if we don't make that move somewhere, and it can be done really briefly, three sentences or so, what we've found, I don't know about you, but we've often found, what people really often will talk about is worship style, right? And that there's just no even capacity to get down to worship's meaning or purpose. And so that's a crucial kind of teaching move. And then what follows is a, and I'll walk through it kind of quickly because we've actually covered some of the related themes earlier. But let me summarize the roadmap of where we're going. The current shorthand summary for describing what is most essential about worship in our work, and I'd like to just talk about it briefly with you as just one answer to the question. Do I think this is the best answer to the question? No, because I think it's contextual to our work. And the answer might be a little different in your context. But the shorthand summary definition of Christian worship that we work with is that Christian worship is formative, I think it's six words, enculturated, it's a little technical, formative, enculturated, Trinitarian, new covenant, renewal. We try to come up with the six-word definition that packs the most punch. We'll just work backwards. Worship is nothing less than this relational encounter. And this relational, this relationship is a covenant relationship with God, not contractual. It's new covenant renewal. So new covenant renewal. This relationship is enacted and this covenant is renewed not only with a Trinitarian God, but with a God who is at work through the power of the Spirit in Jesus Christ. So Trinitarian new covenant renewal. But it's enculturated Trinitarian new covenant renewal, which means it reflects something of the cultural context in which we find ourselves. Without saying that it's enculturated Trinitarian new covenant renewal, that actually is a humility line. That is a humility line. It's saying we have made certain choices in our context that are contextual. And it does not mean that we think we have worship figured out. Right? And I just want to say, I think there's a unique spiritual temptation that all of us face in the field of worship studies. Right? Which is the idea that we have worship kind of figured out. And boy, that is a pernicious problem. One of the tests, incidentally, you know, when people talk about a practice they want to defend in worship is whether their defense would work in a culture halfway around the world, which is a great test. And what I'm talking about here, truly a transcultural element, or is it really contextual? And to me, there is not something lost, there's something gained by affirming we are one church. In one culturally challenged century, in one culturally challenged town, that is working its best in the messiness of community to embody an approach to Trinitarian new covenant renewal. It's actually not selling the store, it's actually gaining credibility from naming the limitations of a particular context. So new covenant renewal, Trinitarian new covenant renewal, enculturated Trinitarian new covenant renewal, and then this will be no surprise, all right? I mentioned Jamie Smith. We talked about the sounds. Formative. And I would say in the last 17 years, that word formative, the relative font size on that word keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And even though, that little six-minute definition I can talk about here in 5 minutes, right? But I think, without using that technical term, those are each concepts or approaches that can be talked about with 8-year-olds in a Sunday school class. And they are concepts that can be talked about in a new member's class in about an hour. I wouldn't use those technical terms in every case, although I'd want to teach everybody the word Trinity, I think. No reason not to. Every reason to. Skim with me really briefly the handout that follows, where you'll just quickly see a couple of the pedagogical moves that help work this out. So now this is taking this definition not backwards like I just did, but forward. So it starts with the expressive informative piece. In life, we have to learn how to talk. We quite often will talk about toddlers. It's one thing for toddlers to learn how to speak. It's another thing for toddlers to learn what to say. Every toddler I've ever met does not need to be trained to say the word no. They do not need to be trained to say the word mine. Right. Living proof of the doctrine of original sin. Every toddler you've ever met. But I'll tell you, they need to be trained to learn to say the words, I'm sorry. Thank you. Help me. You're welcome. Faithful speech is also central to the Christian life. And public worship helps us practice these basic moves. So if you flip over the next page, you see that little chart of the speaking habits in worship. Anne Lamott has this new book on prayer. Have you seen this? The title is something like Help, Thanks, Wow. Is that the exact word, Help, Thanks, Wow? I love that. That's a great teaching title, right? Learning how to pray is learning how to say help, thanks, and wow. Yeah. Incidentally, she used to just have the first two. She just added wow as a category to her teaching. The great doxological move of the contemporary writer, Aunt Lamont. So, watching that unfold. Actually, I think there are a few more than those three basic moves. Right? And so there's a little longer list there on page 2. And isn't that interesting? The specific speaking habits that are listed there, if you list them out and then add their like technical theological term to it, adoration, confession, lament, illumination, intercession, gratitude, dedication, you pretty much get the shape of Western liturgy. The genius of Western liturgy is actually the opportunity to habitually practice fundamental speech effort, acts in a covenantal relationship. That's the one sentence zinger for the seminary final exam. The fundamental genius of Western liturgy is to provide weekly practice in the fundamental speech acts that sustain the divine human covenantal relationship. In human relationships, you need to practice saying, I'm sorry, in order to have the capacity to do it when you most need it to sustain a marriage. Spiritually speaking, we need the practice at growing to have the capacity in these fundamental speech acts to sustain the covenant relationship we have with God over time. Something like that. But those speech acts of speaking to God, upward arrow, are matched next page with the chart of specific listening habits. And here, actually, worship studies is given a lot less attention, incidentally. Speaking of minivan rides home from church, this little chart gives rise to three. How did today's sermon comfort you? How did today's sermon invite you? How did today's sermon correct you? Often, many of us listen for only one or two of those three things. Three great questions. And kids can be brought into that pretty early on. And then ideally, this idea, this is back to the life connection where we started today, right? Sunday, every day and Sunday too. That these basic things we practice in worship spill over to everyday life. so that these are these basic speaking and listening habits echo all week long. And the sounds, next page, are our mentors. Now, just because I was coming to the Institute of Worship Studies, I decided to add here a little page and a half called Brief Supplemental Observations. You see where that is at the end of the handout? And then I called this Formative Worship 301. So this is all like the supercharged theory from what is a kind of basic explanation. Right? And I will say, our time's going to run out, but there are some really good little moments along the way from the history of the church. Like, for example, Athanasius there, the one who recites the psalm, uttering them as his own words. Each sings them as if they were written concerning himself. So the question is, what would be the most fundamental things that we would want to teach about worship to new members? But then let me say where churches run so stuck, it seems to me, is that often the problem isn't with new members. The problem are with key participants in the worship staff who do not share the same fundamental convictions about what worship is. Yes. So worship staff member A thinks that worship is Trinitarian New Covenant renewal. Right? And worship staff member B conceptualizes worship as that moment in the week of the church by which the priestly class, otherwise known as the worship team, reaches up into heaven for a divine gift and dispenses it on the unsuspecting composition. Right? The implicit worship theology is not covenant renewal. This is the embodiment, right? It's the what I call sometimes the spiritual fast pitch, right? Reach into heaven for a word of grace from God, and then bam, we hope you'll like it. Right? Better. And you wind up with two fundamentally different conceptions, and then you go to choose the first song, right? And some worship seminar speaker reads this text from Ken Meadham about pretension's power be broken, and the covenantal renewal person says, whoa, that's a great song, and the person who's like doing this is saying, over my dead body, would we ever sing a song like that, right? The fundamental disagreements that happen over specific actions are traceable to the fact that there are completely different theologies at work for what's going on. Right? Which is why having the collaborative conversation about matching the When You Worship With Us brochure, the Worship 101 class taught with third graders. In a number of congregations that we've worked with in our grants program, the simple exercise of producing a just one-page summary of kind of core commitments about worship ends up being fundamental. And now back to the little Weber distinction around style, form, mechanics, and deep essence and purpose. That one-pager, at its best, should be about worship's deep meaning and purpose, its essence. And then, if there's fundamental agreement about that, the context is created to have the discussion about style and form and mechanics. But unless there's agreement about that, I mean, the reason Institute of Worship Studies sings, and I mean this place, not just sings literally, but sings metaphorically, right? I come here, this is like, there's a buzz, there's energy, curiosity, but it's because there is, as far as I can tell, non-negotiable fundamental agreement about core convictions. And I want to just name and affirm that as one of the great gifts that Robert Weber left us with. He had a great capacity to distinguish that which is fundamental and non-negotiable between that which is inevitably secondary. And so I just want to continue to cheer and affirm all of us in our job of doing that kind of work in our congregations.